when I was younger, to be honest, younger than I can remember, consciously, my parents lived out of the back of a van. And then I came around and, you know, they said, well, this isn't very sustainable. So that happened for a few years. Of course, I was too young to remember the details. But what I did see, and I do remember, is what came next and sort of my dad's process of starting a business to provide a better life than he had to me. And I remember sort of the late nights. I remember the stress, but I also remember the satisfaction that came from that. And I remember sort of, I guess, the entrepreneurial spirit and the result it had on me and my family.
We're diving into bold risk, gut instincts, and building from the ground up with Dylan Hill. Dylan's journey is anything but typical. He left college to support a friend battling cancer, a choice that reshaped his view on risk and purpose. Later, he took another leap, leaving a career of stability to launch CosmoForge, a marketing strategy and CRM consulting firm. Dylan's here to share his journey and the lessons he's learned along the way. Let's talk about some leaps of faith.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
You are welcome. Thanks for coming. I want to really jump right in because I think your story is going to be so interesting and inspirational to all of the listeners of Daring Dreams. So why don't we start from the beginning with you? Actually, no. Let's start with the ending. So tell me a little bit about CosmoForge, what it does, and why you chose to build that business.
Definitely stems from my history. I have seen organizations from the very bottom, from day one, from door-to-door sales kind of stuff, all the way to very large corporations, household names. And I've learned kind of the similarities and the differences between them. And I've enjoyed very much helping people go from point A to point B. So, you know, of course, I haven't quite taken someone from door-to-door sales to Amazon-level business that yet. But that's certainly the dream. And I really enjoy the challenge that it brings working with quite a few companies. So for a bit that I was working in-house in marketing, helping the company grow. And it just doesn't have the same excitement as trying different things. So that's what we do now. I started CosmoForge. And the idea is to help other businesses get from point A to point B, right? And like, of course, that always includes digital marketing, but it goes much beyond that. It includes the processes of what happens when someone calls you. And how do you make sure that you're not kind of taking notes on a sticky note that gets lost in the office or something like that? So yeah, it's kind of the idea, helping businesses grow, taking them from where they are to where they want to be.
Okay. And is there a certain kind of business that you really love working with? If I have some listeners that are that type, who is your ideal client?
Yeah. So we specialize in companies that have high lead values. So if someone goes on a website and calls them or submits a lead form, that is typically worth around $500 for our clients. An example would be a fence contractor, company that sells carports, company that creates custom like camper vans, like the ones that you sleep in when you go to national parks, anything like that, where a phone call is worth at least $500 or so.
When I first found out about you, I heard your story about leaving college. And why don't you share with us a little bit of your background? Because I really want people to know that, you know, you can have a dream and find it and follow it no matter where you start. So why don't you share your journey and I'll just let you talk.
Yeah, there's definitely some highlights. I would say the earliest one was when I was younger, to be honest, younger than I can remember, consciously, my parents lived out of the back of a van. And then I came around and, you know, they said, well, this isn't very sustainable. It's been for a few years. Of course, I was too young to remember the details. But what I did see, and I do remember, is what came next and sort of my dad's process of starting a business to provide a better life than he had to me. And I remember the late nights, I remember the stress, but I also remember the satisfaction that came from that. And I remember sort of, I guess, the entrepreneurial spirit and the result it had on me and my family. And it really stuck with me, and that was very important to me. Though my dad is very much sort of the blue-collar kind of guy. You know, he works in the trades. And so it was something I didn't exactly sympathize with, that side of it. I was very much into computers, into video games, that kind of thing. But I knew I wanted to do something. So I always dreamed of starting something that was important. Fast forward to when I was 17 and started thinking about going to a good college, like every 17-year-old in the world. the sort of the recommendation out there is, hey, spend some time volunteering, spend some time, you know, putting stuff on your resume. And I tried that, and the opportunities available to people around that age were not enjoyable, for lack of a better word. They're filing paperwork, they're not directly interacting with the people that, you know, you really want to be interacting with when you're spending time with the idea of helping them. So yeah, at 17, I created a nonprofit, a charity that uses video games and virtual reality right when it was cutting edge to help kids in the hospital. And I learned a lot from that. I started that because of the experience with my dad, but also when I was young, when I was about 12, the childhood best friend that we'll talk about more later, he was diagnosed with cancer the first time, and we used video games as a way to get through that. So I had this own thing I wanted to solve with myself, which was filing paperwork to volunteer to get into a college feels like a scam for everyone involved. I want to do it in a way that really is important to me and sounds fun to me.
So is that still going?
It is. Yeah, the pandemic really slowed it down, but we're trying to figure out a way to work around that still.
So what's your biggest lessons from that? Because I know I have clients who have started nonprofits. It's not easy. What's your biggest takeaway from that so far?
Don't be afraid of the embarrassing Google searches. You know, I think I Googled every single step of the way, starting off with how to make cake pops, because that's actually the very first thing we did was, you know, do a bake sale. And I think the practical takeaway from that for me is, I think with the internet, there's a lot of expectation of, hey, watch this video and you'll learn how to do everything, or this course is perfect for what you want to do. I've learned that my process is always be content with what you have, but also be aware of what comes next. And we have all these resources out in front of them. Just find a problem and break it down into the smallest fundamental steps you can. And don't be afraid to make those embarrassing Google searches to make it happen. We took the cake pops from door to door, and we ended up raising about $250,000. We worked with some very big companies.
You made $250,000 selling cake pops door to door?
Yeah, and we learned about sponsorships. We learned about grants, all that good stuff.
Okay. Oh my God, there must have been some cake pops.
They were not good at all. That probably made us the first 100. And then from there, you know, then the next Google search was how to make a website. And then it was how to quote email people. And they were not worth that much money. Those cake pops were worth 10 bucks at most. There were moments where things were tough too. I remember I had to step out of my, again, high school yearbook class to receive a call from a children's hospital. And they said that we were banned. Because we used their logo on social media without permission, which I guess agree with that conclusion, but it goes to speak to, I guess, the mindset we were in. Like, we really were just kids, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it also means that just be prepared for those phone calls and those mistakes. And
that's the way a lot of people are learning, especially like self-made people going through entrepreneurism. It's like, you got to make those mistakes to know how not to make the mistakes. You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. And for me, that was devastating. I think in hindsight now, I realize that was the best thing that could have happened. I think it built my muscle up to say, okay, well, that we should expect something, failure to happen. And that's okay. That's a part of the process. Like, the pursuit of failure is more valuable than the pursuit of success, I think. And we got that failure. You know, I was very, very, very upset by that. But it allowed us to do, you know, keep going and figure out new ways to help people. And yeah, yeah. So, and then eventually I did get into college.
Excellent. And then what happened?
Yeah, I was attending for about 2.5 years or so. And that same friend who inspired the creation of that charity, who had entered remission when we were about 13. So at that point, that was 8 or so years later, he was re-diagnosed with cancer. This time the doctors gave him a terminal diagnosis. They said it's going to be about 1 year. And I remember after he called me and he told me that information, we finished up the phone call, and I was in the middle of doing econ homework. And my brain was just like, oh, I got to finish this. And so I started working on it. And 3 minutes later, I'm like, what am I doing here? This is not what it's about. You know, like, it just didn't feel like the right next step to receive that kind of news. And that sort of central thought snowballed into the idea of, well, you know, if he's going to be gone in a year, this person that I've known for so long and has inspired so much of my life, I don't want to be sitting in a lecture hall. And it's such a good reason to, for example, finally do that road trip we always talked about.
Life is so unpredictable, isn't it? It's so precious. I also had a beer, like one of my best friends died of cancer as well. So it's, and young.
Yeah. It's scary. It's confusing. It's a lot of different emotions. Yeah. So, you know, going back to like my dad brought us out of poverty, his vision of, for me, was to go to college. And so that conversation was like, wait, you're going to do this for a friend? Like, how are you going to survive? How are you going to make money? And the answer to that, which is, I guess, kind of a spoiler, was to do freelance marketing. to sort of pay my rent, to pay my expenses. But ultimately, what ended up happening is we put together this little video, explained who we are, what our bucket list was, and we put it on YouTube. And a day later, we had 500,000 views. To this day, we have 250 million across social media.
Wow. We'll have to link that video to this podcast so people can be the 250 million and first viewers.
Yeah, there you go. And most of them are from like reposting through like Good Morning America type stuff. But yeah, it was crazy. It meant that some of the wildest things we had dreamed of doing were accessible. You know, like within that 24 hours, we had a goal. We wanted to feed 100 homeless people. And we had companies like Jack in the Box reaching out to us to just say, go to the local store, buy whatever you want. We'll take care of it. And it was just like the beginning. It got so much more spectacular. Tons of stories I could tell. But sort of the main key one, number four on our bucket list, was to break a world record. We struggled a lot with what that would be. Ultimately, we came to the conclusion that in his case, he had leukemia and he needed a bone marrow donor. And so we said, let's break the world record for the largest bone marrow donation drive. How many can we get in 24 hours? So we partnered with the National Registry. We put together a social media campaign called Lemons for Leukemia. The idea was, when life hands you lemons, how do you make your lemonade? So we challenged people to smash a lemon, blow up a lemon, throw a lemon, to make lemonade.
Oh, I love that.
And that exploded once again. And yeah, ultimately we broke that world record. The last tally was about 13,000 people. And then what really blew our mind is one of those people, complete stranger, 0.006% chance of being a perfect genetic match, was the life-saving donor for my friend. And he's in remission ever since.
I'm so happy. I didn't know that was part of the story. Oh, that's so good. Sorry, that was a twist that I wasn't expecting. Okay.
There's a lot of, yeah. Sometimes they only get the first part out of the story and they're like, oh, I'm so sorry about your friend. Anyway, I got to go. And it's like, wait.
Oh my gosh, that's so amazing. I can't believe you guys found a donor in 24 hours. That's so crazy.
It's hard to believe. It's all anonymous, right? So we don't know who the person was. But because we partnered with the registry, they were able to, we accepted an award from them. And when we were there, they're like, hey, we can't tell you details, but your campaign led to this moment. And we're like, holy crap. That is cool.
And how many other lives did you save?
The last tally was 11.
Wow.
That tally was many years ago. The people we worked with probably aren't even at the registry anymore. That was in 2019, was the last time I heard an update.
Wow, that's a good story.
His end game in that case was, I can live a normal life. And that's what he continues to do. My end game was, holy smokes, I can't believe the world just did that for us.
Yeah.
So we tried to continue the momentum and help other people with cancer, with their bucket list. We helped a few different people. We broke a few different world records. There's this girl, Lexi, from Ohio. We did the world's longest pay it forward chain. So we went to, I'm not sure if there's Dutch Bros up in Canada.
No.
Okay.
Well, not where I am.
Drive through coffee chain. We paid for the person behind us and it lasted for 36 hours. And it's a 24-hour venue. So like it was just pumping the whole time.
Wow. And nobody broke the chain in 36 hours?
Well, that was when someone did break the chain in 36 hours, yeah.
Well, on one hand, like, they shouldn't feel obligated to pay for someone else. They shouldn't have to take on that burden. But at the same time, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall when they made that decision. I was kind of in on it. They knew what was happening, and so...
I might blame the car in front of them, because maybe that guy knew, and he bought, like, a $70 order, and the other guy bought a coffee. You never know, right? He'd be like, yeah, I'll do it. And they're like, oh, it's $79. Yeah, no, forget it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, maybe people were doing the second day in their morning commute and they're like, oh, well, it's still happening. I might as well.
I'm going to buy breakfast for everybody.
Yeah. So that kind of worked out. And then, you know, eventually it was time to be a big kid and do big kid things. So I went back to the workforce, continue to try to do that when possible, just like the other organization. Again, the pandemic really slowed it down, made it quite challenging. But yeah, started working again, and then I just found, I found it very frustrating that I had 70% of a college degree, which is entirely equal to recognize that, but it was just kind of, you know, in the back of my head, the pandemic, like, for a lot of people, just very isolating, so I was like, well, I'm still pretty young, what a great opportunity, I'll get back and, you know, go back to college, finish that up, and I was planning on doing that, and then my brother was like, why don't you just... get a master's instead, you know, at least try to. And so I did that. And yeah, I went and got my MBA. While I was doing that, I was working full time. That was quite a challenge. And probably through the burnout of that, but also through the curriculum, I think I realized I want to continue dreaming big. I want to continue sort of solving random problems. And I want to be able to have sort of the ability to solve those problems, because you can't really solve big problems at a place like Google or large corporations. So, yeah, that is, I graduated about in June of last year, and that's when I started the company as well.
Okay. So your company's so new.
Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of people listening who obviously are inspired by your story. And I think, well, now I have like a zillion questions in my head. I think one of the points that before I ask questions, that your stories make is that people want to help other people. That's human nature, right? And so when you can come up with something like the ideas that you had that are innovative and different and like really connected to the heart, people jump in and support that, right? And so I know for those of you who have been following me, I talk about this a lot and having purpose in your business and tying that purpose to, you know, what you do. So it doesn't have to be what you sell, but it's like that underlying good that your business is doing. And this is just another case in point that says people want to help people. And so if you can be a catalyst for that through your business, wow. And I think that business owners and entrepreneurial people like Dylan are the people who are going to be able to make those kind of big community social gives contributions because we've got these minds that just don't stop, right? So do you incorporate any of that side of your life into CosmoFord yet?
My dream is to be able to build up enough rapport where the service that we provide is charitable marketing. Not necessarily like marketing charities, but more so partnering with large companies to do record-breaking charitable initiatives as a way to get the word out for them. You know, for example, one thing I still do is a scholarship. We run a scholarship in honor of a friend of mine who we lost to domestic violence in 21. And it's just a small little thing, but I'm trying to convince some of our clients, like, hey, you should do a scholarship. It's going to get a lot of buzz towards your website, and it's going to be very rewarding for your employees to, you know, be on the committee and know that they're helping people, and sort of the cascade effect of helping someone's education. Yeah, and then another thing too is like on our onboarding plan, we have sort of all of our own processes, right, of how to do these things. For the first person on the team and intended to going forward, the first 3 to 6 months of onboarding, your goal is to find a nonprofit that is important to you and apply our processes and our training to support them for free. So, you know, if you're onboarded as like a Google Ads specialist,
reach out to your favorite charity, run some Google Ads grants for them, do it in our sort of way so you get up to speed on how to do it. And then, you know, they get some benefit, help out the community, but also you get to, you know, figure out how we roll and our processes. And then when you're good to go, I guess. Instead of doing it internally on like random projects that don't really matter, we might as well dream big with helping people. I'm definitely biased because that's how I started, but I think it's great to do that because it's sort of just like, let's just put our best foot forward for a good cause. And it's sort of a low risk environment to experiment and dream big and try things that you wouldn't be able to do if we threw you into the trenches on a big client, for example.
Sometimes I have a hard time convincing businesses to add this element of contribution to their brands. And, you know, for me, it's like, this is like the base. So if you think about your brand, this little tutorial, and I know Dylan probably knows it. If you think about your brand like an iceberg, it's everything underneath the iceberg that actually really matters, right? So it's how you're different. It's your company values, your company purpose, your positioning and all of that stuff. So, and your brand promise. But your company purpose, usually the bigger you can make your purpose. So if your company purpose is just for your customers, that's great, right? And you can grow. But if your company purpose is for society, I believe you can even grow bigger. And if your company purpose is for even a larger group, then like the bigger your company purpose, the bigger your dream of helping, whether it's, and it doesn't have to be directly doing what you do, right? Like it can just be like, I need to get so big that I can support this cause, right? But anyways, I believe that there's, you know, the customer, the community, and society. And then the bigger you dream, the bigger your company can become. Because I think that the way the world is going is we are all humans who are just wanting to be connected and wanting to matter. And when companies understand that and build that in, it changes lives, but it also changes businesses. If you were to pick a, I guess, piece of advice for somebody starting out, being like about a year in, that maybe would have made your first year a little bit easier, what advice would you give?
I would say whatever sort of fledgling idea you have, break it into the smallest possible baby steps you can to start taking action. So for example, if you have an idea to start a business, you might think, I have no idea how to do a website. I have no idea how to get a business license. I have no idea how to get a physical address or physical shop location. Break those into smaller chunks until you feel like you can start doing something. Because I think a lot of people, they might maybe break into slightly smaller chunks, but it's still too intimidating. And so they procrastinate. They don't jump into the weeds. And as a result, they just don't make progress, but also they just don't learn, you know? And be okay that this baby step you take today might not lead to this dream being very big, but it is sure going to be very helpful the next time you take one more baby step for the next big idea or your next thing that's important to you. And yeah, I mean, I think charities are a great, you know, sort of playground. And while, you know, not everyone might sort of have the time to start a charity like a high school student with tons of free times, think about how you might be able to help an existing charity. And if your concern is, if I start a business, but I don't know how to drive traffic to my website, maybe reach out to a charity and say, hey, I want to learn how to do this. I'll volunteer my time to help grow your charity so I can learn and it'll be free of charge. I don't know, maybe something like that, just to get in there so that you can learn the process of idea, execution, failure, rinse and repeat over and over and over again.
So I have this client who will often give out coupons, like 15% coupons. And she has a business that you just buy online. It's like an online e-commerce kind of service business. And so she had that. And then she had another campaign that went where instead of giving a coupon, she partnered up with a local charity that feeds children. Because she's very passionate about that. And she said, for every sale, we're going to give $5. Well, the $5 was less than 15% coupon. And that promotion blew everything out of the water that we've ever done with that client. And it cost her less. She got to like give like, I can't remember how many bags or like backpacks of food to the vulnerable kids. And like, it was like, is it smart business, but it also like their whole team was behind it. They were excited. They had so much to talk about. Their most engaging posts, their most shared posts, like everything, all like was this campaign. And, you know, it was in our plan to do these community gives like all across the country and stuff. But that was just solidified that when you do it right and when you put the effort in, everybody wins.
Yeah, it's so much more fun for everyone involved.
And like, not at least at the bare minimum, I'm sure $5 are given to a good cause. You know, if it turns out not to work a bunch, at least you tried.
Yeah, and they get something. I mean, otherwise, but the interesting thing is the person buying had to pay the same amount, right? Like they didn't get any discount. So the company contributed $5 for every sale. So it was really good. And I think it just goes to show people do care. And I think in the world today and like all the craziness that's going on between our countries too, like it's just so nice to talk about the good that people are doing. So I thank you for this conversation. It's actually lighting me up a little bit. So I know that you're doing some CRM stuff in your company and systems and stuff. What would be your tip or your biggest advice for a small business who might require a CRM? And for those of you listening, a CRM is a customer relationship management tool to help you keep track of your leads and your contacts and your sales and put them through different sales systems. What's your advice on somebody looking to start to do that and kind of get a little bit like the out of the Excel spreadsheet and into a more streamlined approach?
Yeah. I mean, there's always particulars I can recommend, but I think sort of the philosophy is the important part. And I think it's important because if you are using spreadsheets or you're using physical, pieces of paper, whatever it might be, if you're not using a CRM, it feels as if it's a huge burden to switch over, right? You have to move all your data. You have to learn how to use it. And you have to remember to use it every single day. And you got to pay money. Like, it's not convenient. But I think the way sort of I position it in my head is the value that it provides you. Because I don't think most people start a business to communicate the same thing to many customers or to have to struggle to remember a sort of offer that you provided someone. Like all of these little details that can be tedious, let the CRM do the thinking for you. And if you choose the right CRM, that's exactly what it's for. It's to take all of the unnecessary things that aren't fundamental to why your business is fun, exciting, or why it exists, and putting it into a software to do the thinking for you. So if you're having tons of phone calls with prospective clients, take that out of your head. Release yourself from that stress and let a CRM just keep track of all of that information for you so that you can focus on the fun stuff. You can engage with the client. You can provide the service or the product and focus on... I'm making a lot of assumptions, but focus on what's important about the business and what's fun rather than like the paperwork, because a CRM will more than likely make it way easier for you.
Yeah, I agree, especially some of my clients. I know they need it. They need it desperately. So how do you get around the front, like the initial hesitation with people on those? Like, because you had said, you know, it seems, even for me, I've got a couple clients that I'm like, they actually really need it. But I'm like, it's just such a daunting job.
Which, in my opinion, is not the most compelling reason to get a CRM, but it certainly comes up a lot, is asking my clients or potential clients, what percentage of your leads or your potential customers convert into customers? And more often than not, if they're using spreadsheets or they're using physical paper, they can't answer that question. And then we go down the rabbit hole of, okay, well, you're spending $5,000 a month on Google Ads, and you know that you're getting phone calls and form submits and website traffic, but if you don't know how many of them are turning into actual customers, where's that money going? Like, it could just be going in the trash, and you can't answer that question. So if you want to be able to answer that question, you should get a CRM. And then that opens up a whole rabbit hole of running your ads, running your marketing strategies, considering print marketing versus digital marketing. It all comes down to how do people engage with the actual sales process, the purchase process, rather than the things that can sometimes be vanity metrics that are a little bit more accessible. But that was the most often conversation we have where they'll say, we want more leads. And I say, well, how many are you getting? And they might know that answer. But then I say, how much are you paying per customer, or how many customers are you getting? And then we have to spend 6 hours looking at like set spreadsheets, you know, and trying to figure it out.
Yeah, it's important to know your numbers, right? I remember when I was younger and I was working at Moosehead, the VP of sales, the first day I started, I was the senior brand manager there. He came into my office and he says, if I come in here and I ask you your market share, like how much your competitors' market share, how much you grew this month, what do we grow year over year? Like, you need to be able to rattle that off without spending 2 seconds looking. Like, you need to be so on top of your numbers. I was scared, but I was like, this is such good advice. And that has served me well because I am very analytical. And I mean, obviously I'm heart driven as well, but you got to know your numbers in order to improve on them, right? Yeah. And I think you also touched on another point that was really good about vanity metrics. There is such an over-reliance on vanity metrics in marketing right now. What would you say if, like, for those people who don't understand what vanity metrics are, you had mentioned it. Can you kind of give them an example of what you were talking about when you said vanity metrics?
Sure. I don't know how useful this example will be. You'll have to let me know. But, you know, going back to that foundation I created for my friend, I mentioned about 250 million views. Incredible. But that's not what broke the world record. What broke the world record was people who reached out to us, people who donated money, people who would join us when we were going out and doing community events. Vanity metrics are the things that make you feel good, but they don't actually affect what's important. In our case, it was those things. In your business, it's probably sales or maybe phone calls. But really, it's what matters here and what metrics are associated with that. There's probably a correlation between things like how many views you get on social media, how many followers you have on social media, how many people visit your website. There's definitely a correlation between the stuff that matters. But really, if you're just getting 10 million followers on social media, but they never do anything else, that would be a vanity metric.
Or for the smaller businesses, like if you are just going on and you get like 30 likes on a post or 30 hearts on a post or, you know, something like that, like, and you're like, wow, I'm like awesome, but it doesn't do anything for your business, right? Especially it's a vanity metric too. It's especially really bad if it's just like all your friends just like liking all your stuff. But it is, I mean, obviously visibility is important, but it's not everything. And there's a process, a cycle that happens. And I know on your website, when I took a look at your company, you talk a lot about like the integration of all of the different things and how you work on that. So can you explain for the small businesses who are maybe like wearing a zillion hats and freelancing this and doing this and like, what do they need to look at in terms of having a seamless brand representation or a seamless sales cycle?
I mean, there's a lot of different sort of perspectives to that. I think the CRM conversation always comes up because ideally everything should flow through there. So that is sort of your central source of truth. And I think that's very important. If you have, for example, returning phone calls based on your call history, but responding emails in your email inbox, immediately you're wearing two hats just right there instead of having it in one spot as sort of a gross oversimplification. And then that goes in the conversation about knowing your numbers, right? So at the risk of trying to do math impromptu and on and out loud, the idea is you want to know the value of each marketing engagement. And typically you would start at the lowest of the marketing funnel, or like the most deep engagement you can have with a customer, which is they are a customer. They buy something from you. Then you know that not everyone you interact with is going to become a customer. So the question is, what happens before then? And what percentage of people move from each stage of the process? So for example, if they see an ad on the freeway, about 1% of the people who see that are going to end up moving on to the next part of the process with your company. They might go to your website, for example. once they go to your website, what percentage of them then add to their cart? And then what percentage of them check out? And then what percentage of them actually buy a product? This is not really a revolutionary thought, but the idea is you need to quantify the value of each of those. So if each purchase is worth $500, then how much is an add to cart worth? How much is that billboard impression worth? And I think once you know that, you're able to contextualize all the different places your business might exist. For example, you might get an ad for your own business that says, you know, wrap your car with your logo and it'll grow your business 10x. If you don't have a baseline and you don't have these numbers in place, you won't be able to really compare how that works to all your other places. And so you might just have an idea that sounds good, put it out there, and you have no idea how to gauge its success. You don't know when to end it. You don't know when to combine it. There's just no context to how that connects to everything else. So we're doing that a lot with our clients. An example is someone I spoke with today. Before working with us, they put out a bunch of print ads. And the print ads thankfully have their website and a phone number. But my question was, you know, are you tracking on your website that they came from that print ad? Or are they just direct traffic? Like, can you distinguish them from people who came from your Facebook ads? And if they call that phone number that's on the flyer, is that your front office number? How are you going to know if that phone ringing came from the print ad versus from some other source? And there's technical solutions to all of these things. But yeah, the key takeaway is sort of know your numbers and have a central source of truth so that you can compare the context of all the things you're doing to sort of one through line that's always the same.
It allows you to evaluate, like, are those print flyers or whatever, are they doing anything? Because, you know, as small businesses, like a lot of us don't have endless funds, right? And so if you're not tracking the metrics or figuring out before you do something and put money into something, how are you going to know if it worked? What's the point, right? Because you want to be able to do more of what works.
I would say before you ever launch a campaign, you have to set your benchmarks for success beforehand. Because it's very easy on these platforms, especially if you're working with freelancers, for them to say sort of, oh, we need more data, or like, let's wait a month, which is true. It takes time. But if you don't sort of know when to cut it or know when it's too much, you might just get stuck in the endless cycle of like, well, I tried this thing for 2 weeks and nothing happened. So what do I do now? Well, you can't really say if it was successful or not if you didn't have success defined beforehand.
And you can't pinpoint where the problem is either, right? So here's a really good example that literally just happened to me yesterday. I'm helping a client with Google Ads. The Google ad are, you know, 100%. These are great ads according to the Google, you know, Google Ads manager or whatever, but they're not converting. So it's like, you know, if the ads are working and the ads are above benchmark, so you need to know what the benchmarks are, like how many, like what percentage of the people who click on the ads should be going through, what percentage of people who see them will click on them. If that's high and above benchmark, but you're still not getting conversions, then you know the problem's on the website, right? And so it's like understanding the metrics so that you can fix the problems. And you could be one tweak away from having a campaign work fabulously. But if you don't know the numbers and the benchmarks, you won't ever find that tweak.
Yeah. And that's part of like what my self-intro at the beginning was kind of vague. Because the way that we see ourselves with our clients is, we first establish the benchmark for you. And then we start with the channels, the marketing platforms that make the most sense based on industry experience, based on your company, your customers' expectations, et cetera. But once you create a campaign that is at or above benchmark, we should always be considering other channels. And so that's why I kind of vaguely define us as we take you from point A to point B, because we really see ourselves not as sort of the people you hire to run Google Ads, but like the partner that is always going to be experimenting with wild ideas that may or may not work, but we do it in the context of all the tracking is set up. We help you set up the CRM so that benchmark is there. And then you can do fun stuff, you know, like if you try Google Ads and they don't work, but it's all benchmark, then try something fun and maybe it will work. And I think it's, I don't know, and for me, I'm definitely biased, but it makes it way more interesting to go through the process of, you know, working hard on these campaigns and eagerly awaiting the results if it's not just doing what everyone else is doing.
Yeah. You know, it's like interesting when you're just like refreshed. Like I keep like keep looking at like what every like what the ad or whatever's performance is. Right. It's like I keep checking. I've looked at my phone like 92 times today, but it's not because I'm scrolling social media. Yeah. And I think there's something to be said. And it's a good reminder for people, Dylan, about creativity and the human. Like we're in the age of AI. Like everything's AI. I'm sure you use AI. I use AI. But this idea of doing things big and doing things different and like taking that leap of faith and like that is where I feel like this conversation is going with you. I feel like that's a big part of who you are. But that is a human thing.
Yeah. Definitely.
So how do you come up with like crazy ideas and big ideas?
I think it helps that I've seen the outcome. I know that when I have something I can't stop thinking about and I'm losing sleep over this thing that an average person would think is stupid, well, not all the time, but sometimes it turns out really incredible. And I think knowing that makes it a lot more fun and a lot more sort of worth the effort, worth the shot.
So what happens when it doesn't work out? Have you ever had like something you thought was going to be awesome, big idea, and it like just fell flat?
It's going to sound like that's not the case because I can't think of an example off the top of my head. But it happens all the time, you know. A good example is a client, they do a car detailing. And we put together this Valentine's ad, and it was this whole campaign around, like, make their car shine as bright as their smile. And we paid some actors to do some generated, some user content type stuff, and it felt really good. It felt way better than the competitors' ads, which were just, like, random sales promo. It's not performing well.
Yeah, it's too early.
Well, yeah, exactly. But that's just a recent example. There's much bigger ones.
I don't think it might be 1 week away, right? You know, there's always hope because sometimes it's not as big of, it's not the concept that's missing, right?
Yeah. And if you contextualize it with this campaign exists in this sort of step of the engagement funnel, then yeah, we're not getting a bunch of leads or sales from this big idea. But maybe the purpose of this campaign that we should have set from the beginning was impressions. And maybe in 6 months, when someone is more ready to buy, they'll remember this ad campaign that made them smile. They'll remember this viral thing that happened. And so you just got to be willing to, it's very tempting when we're running small businesses. You need sales now, of course. But if you really think about the numbers and you have it all planned out and you take a step back, think about your benchmarks, there is value in simply engaging with people as long as that's the purpose. And it's contextualized in sort of building a long-term relationship.
A lot of small businesses don't understand the benefit of brand awareness. It's like, I need the money now. I need the sale. But if you build the brand and you build the awareness, those sales will come because you want to be the first one in the consideration set when they're ready to buy. So I think, you know, there is, even though a campaign may not have been exactly what you wanted, there's always, like you said, there's always the benefit of doing something.
I'm not sure if personal injury lawyers are big in Canada like they are here in the U.S.
They exist.
That's a huge industry, but it's an interesting case study because when you think about it, lawyers are not really able to do middle funnel marketing. They can't, for example, or not easily have like an email newsletter list. Right. They can't be like emailing you every month saying, hey, did you follow again? Like call us. It's not work. So they need to sort of address the intense sides of the spectrum, which is brand awareness, or is like Google Ads, right when you're searching for an injury lawyer near you. But they just saturate that awareness because they know, and they always come up with funny slogans. The one everyone's heard of is Better Call Saul, but in reality, someone near here, it's something wrong, call Anne Fong.
Oh,
exactly. And that was really, really, really good brand awareness because when something is wrong, we're going to remember Anne Fong. You will not forget it. And I think every business, you know, they don't need to quite as aggressively do something like what is Anne Fong. But there are opportunities where when someone does need your service, being front of mind because they've been exposed to you so many times, even if they haven't purchased before, is extremely valuable. And that's why jingles are so important, you know, and like the McDonald's arches are so important, because when you're hungry, your brain like is just tricked into thinking of things. But yeah, I agree with you, sure.
Yeah, brand recognition. But of course, every business is unique. And so what one business will need is different. Like exactly what you said, like the personal injury lawyers have a very unique case, right? Case. Oh my gosh. Why? I think it's like so funny to say puns, but it's really not. It's very not cool. So anyways, yeah. So everybody has this different need, right? And everybody has a different sales cycle. And it's up to you as a small business owner and the marketers to figure out like, what is the sales cycle? Where do you need to go in and where are they? And the most important thing, again, and I'm going to say this probably every episode, is understanding your customers. The more you know, the better your marketing.
Yep. What headspace are they in when they need you most? And how do you find them there?
Yeah, because Google Ads are phenomenal for some people, but you might have a product that nobody searches for. And then you are taking a different approach, right?
Yeah. I mean, like the iPhone in 2008 couldn't run Google Ads. No one knew they needed to search for that.
Exactly. Okay, so let's just leave everybody with one more piece of advice, if you have one. As a marketer, what would be your piece of advice for small businesses who are looking to survive?
I would say get your numbers in order as soon as possible and use that to identify your bottleneck. If you're not getting enough customers, everybody wants more customers. You got to figure out where in the relationship with your prospects that's falling apart and focus there. More often than not, it's going to be somewhere around sort of the website engagement part of the funnel is going to be the best part to actually be able to have an impact soon, but also being reasonable with, you know, the way the market works is somewhere in that part of the process.
Dylan, how can people find you and how can people work with you?
Yeah, they can visit cosmoforge.io. They can reach out through the contact form there. And yeah, I like helping small businesses. So if you just want a quick question, quick advice, feel free to reach out. Or we can work together on a regular basis, whatever works.
Well, it was awesome chatting with you. Thank you so much. We'll continue chatting, but everybody else, see you later.
Bye. Thank you.